Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live. We are in Ottawa, Ontario. It is the second day of the CHA as part of Congress 2015. And we are here with somebody from York University who studies music and rap music and the gendered approach to rap music. And it's Francesca D'Amico. And welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is really fun for me because I teach popular culture stuff and you study popular culture stuff in your own research. Mm-hmm. So first of all, what your presentation yesterday, you presented yesterday morning, and it was The Mic Is My Piece, Canadian Rap, The Gendered Cool Pose, and Music Industry Racialization and Regulation. So what exactly were you looking at yesterday?
I was looking at tracing the ways in which African Canadians specifically, who are part of the rap scene, mostly in Toronto, I should say, the ways in which they've appropriated what is called the cool pose in American studies of rap and rap music and hip hop culture more broadly. And I was looking at the ways in which African Canadians have appropriated this gendered cool pose in order to speak back to Canadian multiculturalism kind of broadly, but also particular music industry practices in terms of how the industry is regulated, generally speaking, you know, in terms of things like CanCon, but then how it's regulated kind of on a local basis in terms of how performers access grant funds, how they access mentorship programs, how they access live performance and venues and that sort of thing. And so it's generally used as a technique kind of to talk back and to include blackness as part of the nation. So it's, you know, a conversation of belonging to the state and creating a sense of citizenship, because so often, you know, African Canadians are constantly challenged in terms of, do they belong to the Canadian geographical space? Because Canada is constantly being imagined as a white nation.
Right.
So I use that term, the cool pose, in order to look at the ways in which, you know, black rappers use it as a technique to speak back, challenge, a form of resistance, really.
And is that in the music, or is it go beyond the music? And is it more of a wider cultural thing within the industry? Because, I mean, you know, you can talk about lyrics and
yes,
stuff like that, and obviously that would be part of it.
Right.
But does it go beyond it? Does it speak to a lifestyle? Because I think a lot of people who don't listen to rap music or that sort of stuff see them present a lifestyle more
right,
so than an art.
Right.
Which I think is different from certain other types of music. Certainly there's a lifestyle that goes with rock music,
yes,
per se, or folk music. But I think in rap, it seems like it's an all-encompassing thing.
Right.
That these artists have to live all the time, or at least project that
posture,
they live it.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
And so it goes beyond just the music, right? Or at least
yes,
presenting beyond the music.
Absolutely. I talk about, in my paper yesterday, I talked about the ways in which in Canada, this is also true of the U.S., I should say, but in Canada in particular, black music tends to be kind of collapsed into the genre term urban music. And so within that labeling, you have all kinds of forms of black music, R&B, reggae music, that sort of thing, being collapsed. And they're all using forms of the gender pose, the cool pose, as part of this posturing in order to create a very masculinist pose, I should say, in a way, in order for them to kind of lay claim to a kind of patriarchal power that black men obviously do not have in a white supremacist capitalist system. So it certainly plays a role in all forms of urban music, but also more broadly. I mean, hip-hop culture encompasses more than just music. It's also visual arts, graffiti, breakdancing, and music making in terms of production and DJing. So it's more than just kind of the lyrical ways in which performers do that.
Mm-hmm. And in this country, at least, I mean, it seems as though there's pockets of sort of culture in the big cities. The African Canadian population isn't huge, and it seems to be very centralized in urban
right,
areas, with the exception of places like London, Ontario, which isn't a major urban center in this country. But
right,
otherwise, you know, Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Halifax. Like
yes,
these are where these centers are
yes,
located. So are there regional distinctions as well, given that the conversations between these communities would be so separated?
Right.
That you don't have sort of this continuous line of or pockets around the country, but rather very centralized locations.
Yes.
So do you see differences in that?
there was a project actually conducted, and some of the research material actually is housed at York University. It's called the Northside Research Project, and it interviewed a series of rap artists as participants, and what they said was that rap, in terms of accessing the music market, is incredibly regionalized. And so, yes, the markets that you have identified, places like Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Halifax, they all have their very kind of distinct practices in terms of how musicians access space and create performances. And so, yes, it's absolutely distinct in that way. But I think it's also shaped in interesting ways by patterns of immigration, migration. Mm. So if we think about a place like Toronto and the ways in which Caribbean identity plays such a strong role in how rap musicians characterize, shape lyrically and sonically their sounds and performance, mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting distinction in a way that is quite different from the U.S. Mm. So the U.S., you know, even though African Americans, migration certainly plays a role from places like the Caribbean, it's also kind of compounded by geographical distinctions. You know, a southern sound is very different from an northeastern sound or a southwestern sound in rap music. That doesn't always come into play in Canadian rap music. And that can possibly simply be because Toronto has kind of consistently, over the history of hip-hop in Canada, dominated the ways in which we understand rap music. Mm-hmm. So it very well could be that in the mainstream, you know, there are these distinctions. So if we think like an artist like Shad sounds very different from a Cardinal Official, right? And that certainly, part of that is the history of migration.
To say African-Canadian, I mean, that is a pretty broad distinction in that within that categorization, there'd be a lot of people and different cultures.
Absolutely.
Within that set of people who you might broadly define as African-Canadian, because there is the Caribbean contingent, people from Africa itself, migrants up from the United States. I mean, so there's a lot of different people within that group. So there would be those sorts of divides as well, in addition to where they are in the country and the styles that exist.
Another interesting difference in Canada is that, unlike the U.S., where, for instance, you know, a rapper like Eminem or Macklemore or Iggy Azalea, and she's not American, but I mean, this phenomenon of the white rapper is a constant discussion. What I've come to find, at least in my interviews with Toronto rappers, is that the white presence in rap was existent from the beginning. This was not, they're not an anomaly. Mm. And interestingly enough, you know, we can also look at the relationship between hip hop culture and the First Nations community, Indigenous people. That's also an interesting phenomenon in terms of how rap is differently taken up in these communities. Mm. So Canada is an interesting place, you know, in terms of looking at rap as a burgeoning area of study to understand the ways in which youth and the city interact with music and how they help us understand places and differences in terms of race and gender and class, indigeneity. Mm-hmm.
Well, this issue of white rappers I find really interesting, given that I grew up in the suburbs of Toronto and the further suburbs, so it was primarily white. Mm-hmm. And you have people who are, you know, teenagers, right, who are sort of co-opting an urban appearance and listening to this music. And I always find it confusing because the things that, at least in the lyrics, that a lot of these people are speaking about is living as a marginalized individual. Mm-hmm. And yet it's co-opted by these middle-class white kids who somehow find a connection to it, I guess because they feel marginalized in their own way. But is that something that the African-Canadian community or black rappers look at white artists and say, well, you're just co-opting us because we're the ones who have been pushed to the sides, and this is our way of expressing that?
Right.
You haven't had those same obstacles in your life, so how can you take that same message? Like, it can't mean the same to you. Is that an issue at play?
In the research I've done, it's certainly come up, but within the context of reflecting on American rap music. Some of the rappers and DJs that I interviewed in my research, particularly in the case of this paper, they didn't talk about Canadian peers, so other, you know, members of the hip-hop community who were white in that same kind of fashion. Mm-hmm. And they don't tend to actually talk about audience in that way. So, you know, white audience members who come to shows. So it's interesting that that seems to be part of their understanding when they reflect on American hip-hop culture, right. But not
right.
Canadian. And I don't know the differences or the reasons for that, but it's certainly that seems to be apparent.
Mm. Could it just be something as simple as market?
It could be. And something that's true of Canada that is not at all true of the U.S., at least was in its early days, but certainly not true anymore. Canada, the markets are very niche, localized, and in order to experience kind of homegrown rap music, it's still very much kind of a live performance phenomenon. And a mixtape phenomenon where artists actually creating their own CDs and handing them out at shows. Mm. So it's a very different kind of marketplace in Canada in terms of how rap is performed and disseminated than the U.S. And so they're also, that kind of experience is also compounded by just the ways in which the business practices kind of play out in the Canadian landscape.
Mm. Yeah, because when you look at the people who really make it, and by make it, I mean commercially successful.
Right.
That would be, what, like Cardinal?
Cardinal, Fischel.
Drake.
And to some degree, Shad, Kanan. Sure.
Yeah.
Who have all had some kind of interaction with the American marketplace.
Right, that's the thing, right? You have to go south to
exactly.
make a lot of money.
Yes. And that seems to be the distinction between artists like the ones we've just mentioned and some of the more pioneering artists, at least in our eyes, in terms of people who have kind of laid the groundwork or foundation for the rap movement in Canada, but who don't have that kind of prestige or star status in terms of album sales and that kind of thing. The things that, I guess, matter, right, to people who study popular culture or who think about artists in the popular culture landscape.
Right. Right. Like, in my popular culture courses, generally speaking, it's mainstream.
Right. Yes.
Right? The people who are... Because I teach popular culture as a commercial enterprise. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's the people who are commercially successful...
Exactly.
Who I tend to focus on. It's, you know, that underground stuff doesn't really get discussed until the underground stuff becomes mainstream. Which
right.
happens, say, in sort of the New York scene in the 80s. When
right.
the underground rap music or hip-hop music starts to bubble up, and then it really has an impact
right.
going forward. That's
right.
when it. That's when we talk about it. But otherwise,
right.
I mean, it's, you know, the easy way to look at popular culture is commercial. If you're
absolutely.
Not commercially successful, then what impact do you have? Which makes sense when you're teaching a survey course.
Yes.
Right? And you have to go through the whole 20th century.
It's, right.
It makes sense to do it that way. But in something like this, I mean, that underground culture is going to have an effect on those guys who are commercially successful.
Absolutely.
Because they have to speak to that community as well.
Right.
And
they are interacting with them to some right. degree in terms of performance or people who are helping them produce their own albums. Mm-hmm. And so there's certainly an understanding. And when you speak to artists, they don't actually kind of create that division themselves. That distinction, I think, is much more kind of a marketplace distinction.
Right.
And in rap culture in particular, there seems to be a privileging of underground versus mainstream, a question of what is more authentic,
right.
What is perhaps more conscious or intellectual.
Right.
And that's a discussion that is really prevalent in rap music, more so than perhaps other genres of popular music.
Right, because that's something that there's this idea of, if you're going to get mainstream success, you have to basically say nothing, right? You can't be super controversial. You can't actually express yourself the way that you could on the underground. So,
right.
And I don't think that is just a rap phenomenon. I think that's...
It's true of certain genres.
Certain
we might
genres.
Say folk music,
right.
things where authenticity plays a real
right. Or even, I'm thinking even like stand-up comedians. Right, some of the people who you see at smaller clubs
right.
say things that are a lot more potentially offensive than Jay Leno ever did. Right,
right.
But Jay Leno makes a lot more money and still
right.
makes a lot more money than some of these smaller club guys. So
mm-hmm.
then there's that question of authenticity, and some
right.
of the underground people make fun of that because he's not saying anything.
Right,
he's not being real. So that sort of dynamic, it strikes me that it's possible that it creates some tension. That these underground guys, and I don't like the word underground because it makes it sound marginalized, which
right.
I don't mean, but sort of the ones who are playing smaller clubs, interacting with their audience more than mm-hmm. sort of these big millionaire.
Mainstream Max.
Mm-hmm. That there could be some tension there. That this notion of, well, they sold them, right? They're not being true to the roots of the art, and then therefore it's meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
But the sense I'm getting from you is that it's actually a little, it's not quite that tense, and there's actually more cooperation there.
I think so, in some instances. I also think that narrative is in part, you know, created by the industry, of course, mm-hmm. and to some degree, the audience as well. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of audience members, or what we call, you know, hip-hop heads in the context of rap music, they have kind of very heated debates around mm-hmm. what is worthy rap music and what isn't, you know, mm-hmm. constantly around this question of authenticity, intellectual lyrics or mm-hmm. conscious lyrics. And audiences play kind of an important role in perpetuating that discussion, mm-hmm. you know, around rap music.
Right. And is it a question of audiences sometimes putting their own meaning on lyrics to them?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that would change perhaps the artist, or the artist's intent may not be actually
perfectly lined up.
Yeah. Which is always an interesting dynamic, I
mm-hmm.
find,
absolutely.
When that happens. Now, the other thing that we have to talk about, too, is you look at rap music from a gendered perspective as well.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of people who don't listen to it a lot, which I'm in that category, think of a lot of rap music as somewhat sexist.
Yes.
Is that a fair impression that some people would have?
I think it's certainly a part of rap music. And over the course of the 1980s and 1990s, the ways in which rap music, at least in the mainstream, comes to be represented and presented is more and more so misogynistic and sexist. It becomes kind of very narrowly represented as one of the only ways in which we can understand particularly black masculinity. But when I talk about, you know, rap as being gendered, I make the argument, at least in my own work, on both sides of the border, because I actually study the U.S., but I've done work on Canada, that rap has always been gendered in the sense that it's coded as masculinist in many of the ways that it's postured, in terms of the ways that rappers speak, how they pitch their voices, the kinds of things they say lyrically, their performance styles. It's all been coded by a particular form of hegemonic masculinity in a sense for rappers to kind of align themselves with the patriarchal power system. Mm. And that this isn't only something that the men in the genre take up, that women very consciously take up forms of male posturing in order to solidify themselves within the genre, to appear more respected, more authentic, because authenticity is so central to being a rapper and being respected within the genre. So that this isn't something that is simply, you know, a male way of performance, that women also take up these forms in order to garner respect within the genre. And that over time, and, you know, when we're talking about hip-hop comes to be invented, or is birthed, mm-hmm. at least at the top of the 1970s. And over time, at least as it's represented in the media, it becomes more narrowly represented as a very kind of hyper-masculine, violent, at least in terms of its approach to women, mm-hmm. male gaze-like,
right.
form of music. And that's only one form of rap music, you know, and the most obvious example, of course, is gangster rap. You know, gangster rap was kind of the height of that misogynistic rap music. But it's certainly the case that it's been gendered from the... I make the argument that it's been gendered from the beginning, and that it just becomes more narrowly cast over time.
Mm. Well, yeah, that style that you talk about, I mean, I think people... I shouldn't say people. I look at rap music and I see it as very aggressive in terms of its lyrics and the way in which the artist performs on stage. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not passive.
I think it's easy to say that if we only look at the mainstream. Mm-hmm. If we looked at examples, obviously from the underground, or artists who kind of, in some ways, sit between the underground and the mainstream. You know, an artist that comes to mind is Common, for example, and his mm-hmm. song, The Light. He's absolutely not a misogynistic artist, mm-hmm. or a rap artist. He's certainly an artist that the mainstream is aware of, the underground is aware of. He's you know, respected in both terrains. And his work is absolutely concerned with creating a positive interpretation of masculinity and representing women in a way that is respectful. I mean, he certainly has examples in which his music is lyrically aggressive, and that's part of a technique in rap called boasting, which is kind of to affirm your position. And it's lyrically aggressive in the sense of how it creates its wording. It's not necessarily aggressive in terms of saying anything harsh towards women, mm-hmm. but in the words they choose, it mm-hmm. comes off as aggressive language.
Right.
And so that's characteristic in some ways of his music, especially in the case of when he's doing what is called a battle record or trying to affirm his worth as a rap mm-hmm. artist. But lyrically, in terms of content, he wouldn't be an artist that we could say is misogynistic.
Mm.
So there's examples.
Sure.
But mainstream culture in some ways has a vested interest in representing black masculinity in a particularly narrow way.
Mm-hmm.
And rap music is part of this
right.
process.
Right. I was just thinking more on the lines of, regardless of what they're saying, oftentimes when you see it, they're on stage, and it's even the pace of a lot of rap is faster, and sometimes someone who speaks really quickly can be interpreted as aggression. And it, oftentimes you find that if they're on stage, I've noticed this, that they tend to be sort of bent over and sort of almost getting in the face of the people in the front row,
mm-hmm.
like sort of projecting a dominance,
mm-hmm.
right? And that seems aggressive, and not in a violent way or in a negative way, but it seems as though in rock music, it would be called stealing the show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like just being a great performer.
Right.
But I think, and maybe it is this racialized vision of it, but in rap, it seems more aggressive for some reason. And almost as if there's an antagonism towards the audience.
Right.
Which I don't think is actually the case.
Right.
But sometimes it could be interpreted as such.
I tend to agree, and I agree that that's certainly the discourse.
Mm.
In my own work on the U.S. and popular music, I also study soul and funk music. And I make the argument that in the late 1960s, when soul was actually transitioning out of kind of a politics of respectability, so we can think of an example like Motown.
Mm.
When you look at its opposite, its southern opposite, which was Stax Records, and you think of an artist like Otis Redding, Otis Redding was often thought of and written of, you know, he was obviously an artist of high talent. But if you look at his performance techniques, he was often represented as kind of leaning forward, leaning backwards. And it was part of, it wasn't just a kind of racialized perception of performance, but it was also class-based, because he represented himself as kind of a working-class black man.
Mm-hmm.
And so representations of the body were coded by both race and class.
Mm.
And the ways in which his body and bodies like him, or the way that the bodies were postured, were certainly discussed within the context of, you know, concepts like primitivism.
Mm.
That the ways in which you kind of line your body up and your relationship to the audience, or your proximity to them, mm-hmm. signified a certain kind of respectability or lack thereof.
Right.
So this certainly predates rap music, and mm-hmm. rap music is an extension of the lineage of an artist like Otis Redding from Stax, mm-hmm. An intention to mm-hmm. place forth or posture a particular kind of black working class identity,
mm-hmm.
or black underclass identity, as separate from the politics of respectability that a label like Motown would have been representing.
Mm-hmm.
So it certainly predates rap, I guess,
sure.
is my point.
Sure, and you know, the same, you know, a similar thing probably took place in the 20s with jazz music.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean,
yes.
Similar things as African-American jazz artists became popular.
Yes.
And there was this notion of, well, it's projecting an African-American culture, and it's different, and it's unique, and it's something that the community can attach itself to. And the white American communities would look at it differently.
Absolutely.
And it is the racialization of this is really interesting, because of that, particularly the right in the United States looks at these things very negatively historically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the 20s it was, you know, this jazz music is just leading to moral decay,
right?
And this, right, I teach about that in the mm-hmm. pop culture stuff, and the same then in the 50s with more, not jazz, what would you,
rhythm and blues,
yeah, R&B type
music.
Yeah,
yes.
Like Muddy Waters and those sorts of people.
Absolutely.
Who are seen as very destructive forces. But then you have someone like Elvis who comes in and basically co-ops it all,
right?
And makes millions of dollars and
right.
is seen as this icon.
Mm-hmm.
And the racialization of that is quite remarkable. And I'm not the first to comment on that. That's been commented on a
right.
lot, of course. But
right.
And it seems as though the same similar things happen in rap, that
mm-hmm.
once it can be seen as negative and aggressive, but then if it gets co-opted or becomes acceptable to a white audience, mm-hmm. the mainstream interpretation of it changes.
Yes.
Which, is it simply race that's why that happens? Or is there something else going on that, like a wider shift with the liberalization of arts?
Some of the research I've done has been on, I wouldn't even say that it's simply the terrain of, you know, the conservatives or Republicans. Mm. There have been instances where, you know, liberals or progressives or Democrats have squarely attacked rap music for, you know, this same kind of language that was prevalent in the 1920s and 30s mm-hmm. around jazz, you know, this question of moral decay.
Yeah.
That was certainly levied by President Bill Clinton in 1994 right. yeah. Against rap music and gangster rap in particular. So I think these discourses and debates become, you know, they're not simply about race. Mm. They also become kind of, the waters become muddied by gender, mm. class, sexuality, certainly. Mm-hmm. You know, at the height of the culture wars in the 1990s, at least in the U.S., this was a question, moral decay was centered around questions of sexuality in these discussions in very many ways. And they became taken, they got taken up by different communities in different ways. So
right.
in some instances in the black community, it was certainly a question about race and respectability. You know, among Democrats, it was about moral, or I should say family values and sexuality.
Right.
So it depends
yeah.
on what community we're mm. talking about mm. in particular. So, mm. yeah, and so perspective, I guess,
right.
makes
right.
a difference.
Yeah, and certainly there'd be issues of power at this as well.
Absolutely.
Because you mentioned that earlier. A lot of the artists are people who have been marginalized or coming from marginalized communities. Even some of the white artists, someone like Eminem, who grew up in a lower class neighborhood, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a marginalized community there.
Right.
And the aggression, or what is perceived as aggression, is simply an assertion of
working class or,
yeah.
you know, white underclass identity.
Right.
Yes,
right.
absolutely.
Yeah. So this question of sexuality is also really, I think, important because, come back to the word aggressive, a lot of lyrics can be interpreted as aggressive towards women in a sexualized way.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a story recently that, was it Snoop Dogg said he wasn't going to use the word hoe anymore or something?
Oh, is that so?
I think I read that. If that's not true, I'll cut it out. But someone came out that they weren't going to use negative words towards women anymore.
Okay.
But that has been a major part of rap music for a long time.
Absolutely.
The language that could be viewed as very demeaning towards women.
Mm-hmm.
Or how then do women relate to this music in a way that is positive for them, given the language that's used? Because you have lots of women in these audiences who listen to this music, who are fans of this music, yet the lyrics themselves can be seen as very demeaning towards them. Like, so how does that relationship between artist and female fan manifest itself?
I think in some ways, if we think particularly about artists, a lot of them speak of taking back words and reconstituting them or recontextualizing them to empower themselves. Ho is one of those words. Obviously, there's, you know, there's rap groups who actually have taken up that word as part of the, you know,
right.
their trio name or something like that. So I think certainly part of that is taking back words and arguing that they give a particular person power. You know, there's been a lot of debates around whether when a rapper uses the word bitch, if he's necessarily speaking about women themselves.
Right.
So they might be using the word to kind of reference another male rapper,
mm-hmm.
you know, in what was called a diss record. But certainly that has gender dynamics as well. Because,
sure.
because there's some kind of
the feminization of that
absolutely.
Man, right? Yeah.
So in terms of how audience members, female audience members, consume music that is considered a demeaning,
mm-hmm.
I don't do much work around that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not necessarily kind of concerned with the audience in
right.
that same kind of capacity. So I can't necessarily speak to that in my work. But I think women don't necessarily always, or in some cases, ever consume it thinking gender or
okay.
gender only.
Mm.
Sometimes it's other elements, right? If we think about the visual elements, there have been many instances, particularly in cases of, you know, hip-hop journalists who actively speak out in terms of the lyrical and visual representation of women. Mm-hmm. So there has been a lot of pushback as well. Right. Much of the way in which women consume hip-hop is not always or necessarily passive. Mm-hmm. So in some cases, you know, that doesn't seem to play a role, or they ignore it, or in other instances, there's a real kind of resistance towards that kind of music. And there has been, within kind of the history of hip-hop music, there has been a real growth of hip-hop feminisms as a response to or way of rethinking through rap music, despite this sexist, misogynistic language.
Right. Well, have you, in your interviews with artists, have you addressed the issue of some of these, the language that's used, and particularly as a female scholar, and someone who looks at this through a gendered lens?
Yes.
Is that something that bothers you, and that when you're interviewing someone who maybe has used some of this language, is that something that you address personally?
I've asked the question particularly of pioneering rap acts in both the U.S. and Canada. I've asked them about the ways in which gender played out in their lyricism and the way they thought about rap music. Mm-hmm. And many of them said, you know, in the early days of rap music, and in Canada, it's, you know, almost a decade after the U.S., but in the early days of rap music, male rappers, at least, they weren't, it wasn't kind of a primary objective to speak about women like that. It was, they spoke about women as kind of conquest and leisure,
right?
Which they didn't necessarily consider to be sexist,
right,
in its language. Well, and so many of them kind of described away their use of these words, ho and bitch. They didn't seem to think that it was necessarily sexist, especially in cases where they were talking about male rappers, when they were using it as a way to offend them. They didn't see it as a way to kind of effeminize their peers. So that doesn't seem to be part of kind of the way they understand that terminology.
Therefore, it might be unfair of an outside person to put that on them,
to read it as such.
Right.
It's fair as well. I think it goes both ways. But so I think it's a lot more nuanced than we might want to read onto it. That isn't to say that it isn't sexist.
Sure.
But simply their way of understanding is much more complicated, I think, than it has been read, I should say.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned this idea of women as leisure and conquest. I mean, that's very much a male locker room idea, right?
Of
how men in groups tend to talk about women. Again, not that that's right, but that tends to happen. And when you're in a situation where it's mostly men, particularly early on or in these underground clubs, if it's mostly men who are sitting backstage doing whatever, coming up with these lyrics, then that's how that's going to manifest. The same way that in a locker room of hockey guys in their 50s are going to talk about this sort of stuff.
Right.
And it doesn't make it right. But it's be unfair to say, well, you can't do that, because men tend to do that. Or to say that this is emblematic of this culture.
Of rap culture.
Of this culture,
It's absolutely kind of, rap culture is, it's kind of a microcosm of the larger kind of structural forces in both Canadian and American society.
Right.
An interesting thing, an interesting example in rap music is an artist like, for example, MC Light, who puts out a song called Roughneck, I believe, in 1994. And what she does is she almost appropriates that kind of locker room language of looking at, you know, flipping the gaze and looking at men as leisure and conquest.
Right.
And which is, it's a perfect example when we think about how the gendered cool pose is used in order to establish a particular set of norms and practices within the genre.
Right.
So it's certainly not only the terrain of male rappers. Women use it in very interesting ways to challenge the language of gender and the ways in which male and female, in the context of heteronormativity at least, relate to one another.
Right, yeah, because artists like, I know Missy Elliott has done a lot of stuff, or in her lyrics talk about sexual proclivities and that sort of stuff, and same with Little Kim or something.
Little Kim, yeah.
They talk about these ideas, and it's really interesting when you look at it in that dynamic of they're taking a generally masculine view of sexuality and taking that for themselves.
Right.
And it's, to me, it's very empowering. Despite the fact that some of the lyrics sometimes can be very specific as to what they're doing.
Right.
But okay, fine. I mean, that is what it is. You don't have to necessarily like the lyrics themselves, but the overall purpose of what they're doing is really quite remarkable, and something that within rap music, it seems as though there's more opportunity to do that than people in, say, rock and roll. I mean, rock and roll talks about sexual stuff all the time.
Right.
But people like Joan Jett or those sorts of rock female musicians, you don't see them do that as much. They're talking more about overall female empowerment.
Right.
As opposed to flipping a male gaze the other way.
Yes.
And that opportunity for female rap artists strikes me as somewhat unique.
Yeah, I think, again, that has a lot to do with the way that the genre is coded. Mm-hmm. There's certain codes or practices that are required in order to be a rap artist. Mm-hmm. The codes that make you authentic. The codes that make you respected within the circles of practitioners. I think that has a lot to do with the ways and the reason why, I should say, female rappers use or are able to kind of flip that language in order to empower themselves.
Right.
It's certainly informed by the nature of rap, which I argue is highly masculinist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, as we talk, I keep thinking about, I went to the Berks last year.
Yes.
And talking about, you know, how masculinized cultures can, and a lot of times, be very negative, even destructive forces. And the one case that I remember is talking about the banking industry and the masculization of the banking industry that ultimately led to very negative consequences around the world for a lot of folks. And there was this notion there of, well, bring in women, bring in a feminine idea or a feminization of these industries because it'll lead to a better balance, or women ask different questions, these ideas. But it was always from a women's perspective, and it was never this idea of what if women took the masculine gaze and sort of flipped it for a sense of empowerment.
Right.
And that's really quite unique.
Yes.
In this area.
In the context of black popular culture, I should say rap, I think, and there's a lot of scholars who have argued this and through their research, rap takes out of, you know, the history pages of blues music. So we can look at artists like Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith. Many female rap artists are doing some of the same work that these 1920s blues women were doing in terms of taking a genre, in the case of blues, highly masculinist, and using it and flipping it to speak about, to provide their own perspectives and to empower themselves. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly a very interesting kind of relationship between both musics, not only in terms of gender, but the ways in which working class, underclass identities are reflected and represented in the music.
Yeah, and that's why I love looking at this sort of stuff, because you can see the traces of it and the evolution of it and how it all sort of fits together. And by no means is it complete. I mean, these questions are going to continue to be asked, and there's going to be evolution of how these things are done, particularly now in an era where you might be able to argue that mainstream doesn't exist anymore. That people can get what they want to get whenever they want.
Right.
Right? That radio stations are shutting down, TV stations are shutting down, or at least don't have the same type of audience. Right?
Exactly.
Arguably,
it doesn't have the same kind of power that it used
to. Well, at least not mainstream, but maybe that gives rise to more of these sort of underground people, or gives them more exposure, and it leads to more discussion amongst artists, and then more discussion amongst fans.
Right.
And people who are consuming it, and could really just lead to maybe a democratization of it, or a greater democratization of it, or just changes in the culture that we don't know yet, or we can't see yet.
We can't see it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But and how that manifests itself in terms of gender will be quite interesting, I think, because
I would agree.
Right, the barrier to entry continues to be lowered, so more dissident voices, say, can be included.
Yeah, I would. And in terms of rap music, many female rappers have, you know, insisted upon the fact that rap music isn't simply the barriers aren't simply in terms of access as performers, you know, being a female rapper, but they're complicated by things like production. So it's very rare, for example, at least in the U.S. context, that you hear about an American rap producer in terms of right. record producer, right? There's the most famous ones are tend to be male. And so the even just the experience of recording is highly masculinized. And so there's questions of access there. And I think as we continue on and YouTube, you know, continues to be a real kind of predominant phenomenon, we will see that there are, which has always been true, which is that there are always, there have always been a multiplicity of female rappers. They just have not tended to have access to the mainstream. But that doesn't mean that they don't exist. And so, you know, forums like YouTube will make that, hopefully at least, more visible.
Because and one thing I've always noticed too, and I'll go back to comedy, that because I think there's a similarity between comedy and rap music for women performers. In a stand-up comedy club, there's this notion of a female comic has to be twice as funny to get the same laugh as a man, a male comedian, because there's a skepticism on the part of the audience that women can be funny, which of course isn't true. But you know, I've been in clubs where there's been female comics who have been really funny, but don't get the same reaction from their crowd as the male comic who comes on next and isn't nearly as funny. And I would guess that a similar thing exists for female rappers, that the expectations of them are higher.
And you hear about this particularly in audience circles, male audience circles. So when you ask men, you know, what do you think about female rappers? Well, you know, most of their responses, at least in my experiences of talking with them, has been, you know, female rappers, they absolutely have to be, you know, they have to be kind of lyrically astute and talented. If they're not, then I just, I can't, I can't give them that level of respect as a lover of hip hop. And so there seems to be a constant discussion about lyrical talent, being able to be smart and witty on the microphone. If women don't have that in their toolkit, then they just don't, at least in the context of the ways in which these male audience members have spoken to me, they just don't give them that kind of equal respect. Whereas a male rapper who is kind of haphazardly talented, he'll be accepted. He won't be praised. He won't be kind of considered among the legends or, you know, the best lyricists, but he'll be tolerated. Whereas female rappers, that doesn't even become a question.
And that just on its own really speaks to how masculinized the culture is. That is true, and it's such a double standard, and it's not fair, and it's the sort of thing that has to be combated, but it exists, and it's the sort of thing that people like you can go and investigate why this is and how.
And it's certain, and it plays an, it's yet another barrier. In terms of access, that audiences themselves help create and and strengthen in some ways.
And because, I mean, for if you're a hyper masculine guy going to a show to see a woman up there, maybe it, just that on its own, like that, it, the position of power of having somebody literally above you on a stage. Right, could be a demasculinizing situation, and maybe that on its own puts you in an uncomfortable position right off the top, and therefore you're looking for things to say
to
that she's not good,
right,
and that gets your power back,
right,
and that it, those are the sorts of dynamics that hurt female performers.
Absolutely, and it can be a question of lyricism. It could also be a question of. You know, the male gaze in and of itself empowers men. And so if women, you know, engage in a particular kind of sexualized performance, even that in and of itself, despite lyrics, they might not be lyrically astute, but they kind of put on a particular gendered and sexualized performance that gives, you know, questionably gives men back, audience, male audience members back their power. And so they can accept them in those ways. So yes, it's an interesting interplay between, and I would be interested to see even among, in terms of kind of female rap acts, what the audience demographics are. Artists like MC Light, who consciously gendered herself as masculine in many ways, it, you know, and from everything in terms of the clothes she wore to how she pitched her voice, she had much more of a kind of male audience demographic than a group like Salt-N-Pepa, for example. In many ways, that's because of how they postured themselves in performance and the clothes they wore, how they, you know, the lyrics and their voices. Voices play such an important role in rap music in ways that I think have yet to be interrogated in scholarship.
So you like sort of a deeper pitch versus
absolutely,
a higher, right?
Yeah. Absolutely, in terms of it, versus a higher pitch rap delivery.
Right, and that would go back then to these questions of authenticity and what would be the authentic rap voice.
Absolutely.
So before we wrap up, I want to talk about this other project that you're working on. This, I could talk about this stuff for a long time. But we don't have this room for that long. The other thing that you're working on, in addition to finishing up your stuff at York and moving on to bigger and better things,
hopefully,
is this coloring book project that you have going on.
Yes.
So talk about this.
So I'm currently a film producer on a documentary project called Coloring Book, the Mixed Race Documentary. And I'm working with a director-screenwriter out of the U.S., Jason Cuthbert. And what we're doing is we're looking at the history of mixed race identity and interracial marriage in the post-civil rights era through to the Obama era. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at it both from a kind of an intellectual storyline and an emotional storyline. So we'll follow a particular family, three generations of multiracial identity and interracial marriage. Mm-hmm. So at every kind of level, a generational level of the family, there has been interracial marriage. And so, and this family exists on both sides of the 49th parallel. So they're in the U.S. and they're also in Canada. So what we're going to be doing is a cross-cultural comparison in terms of the ways in which both countries understand notions of multiculturalism, interracial marriage, multiracial identity, and how all of these things are navigated. And we'll obviously be including the work of experts who, you know, everyone from academics, obviously, who study mixed race identity and interracial marriage, as well as, you know, politicians, performers of note, all of whom have kind of a deep understanding of race and identity. And what makes our project a little bit different than other film projects that have interrogated this content is that we'll be looking at the psychology, particularly of these relationships, and how that, you know, deeply informs identity in ways that mixed race scholarship, which is quite new in terms of a discipline, is interrogating these days. And we'll also be kind of pushing the boundaries in terms of when we think about mixed race, especially in the context of the U.S., we often think of a black-white divide.
Right.
And other mixes or people of color are not often included in that discussion.
Right.
So we don't often think about interracial dynamics that don't include whiteness, because so much of mixed race studies or conversations about mixed race often have whiteness at the center. And so that's something that our project hopes to look at more deeply. And so this is, you know, a documentary that we're currently in production on. Our hope is to continue building this project beyond the documentary. We're hoping to do kind of a three-tiered project that will, you know, look at other dynamics, things like the ways in which the marketing world approaches mixed race identity. And we'll be doing it kind of in the form of other filmmaking work, web series, books. So it's a kind of a long-term project that we're trying to establish.
What was the genesis of this? How did this come about?
It is interesting. So the filmmaker and I met on Twitter.
Okay.
So social media plays a really interesting role in this. So we met on Twitter, and we're both interested in questions of race and identity, and we saw this particular issue. The filmmaker himself is biracial, and so this obviously is both kind of he has a personal interest in telling this in this story, but also professional interest in just. We're deeply concerned by the question of diversity in the media, or the lack thereof, diversity in media representations. And so part of our production company's mantra is to include stories of those who just simply are not represented in mainstream forms of media. And one of the stories that at least the filmmaker felt best equipped to tell was one about mixed race identity. So where better to start than something that you obviously deeply identify with and are, you know, passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a personal connection to it, it always makes it better somehow.
Somehow, right? Yes.
I don't know, that passion, those intangibles that go along right. with making a project great.
Right.
When you have that personal connection, it really you can tell when yes. a person truly cares
yes.
about a project versus they're doing this because it's their job.
Right.
Right. So yeah. people want to support the project. You were sort of going around seeking support for it. Is that...
Yep.
Did you meet your goal? You're still looking for people?
We did meet our goal, but
terrific.
You know, there will be fundraising. We'll still be in, you know, raising money for a film is a long drawn out process. It's an right. interesting process that I've learned, mm-hmm. especially in the age of crowdfunding mm-hmm. and the ways in which kind of the film industry has shifted in terms of how it goes about producing a film.
Right.
So that's been an interesting learning curve for myself, mm-hmm. Who's transitioning, you know, in this case from academia into documentary work. Mm. So there will be certainly initiatives to continue building funds for the film, you know, over the course of the next few months.
Right.
But if people are interested in learning more about the project, we do have a website, www.coloringbook.info, and we actually spell it coloring
the right way. I see. I'm on the site
the
right
Canadian
now.
The Canadian way,
and
the
yeah.
British way.
Yep.
C-O-L-O-U-R-I-N-G. Mm-hmm. We also have a Twitter presence. So the at sign and our handle is coloring coloringbk mm-hmm. and you can also from that page find my Twitter handle yep. hiphopscholar82 and the directors as well A2Jason
yes and on your Twitter page here for the project you have the hashtag make diversity normal in all caps
yes
and and hashtag diversity wins with wins in all caps.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And if you, yeah, like I say, I'm on the site right now. So if you go through, there's updates here, who's on the team, the story of what you're doing and opportunities to support it as well. So, it's a great project and it sounds good. And what sort of timeline are you looking at for this? I know you said it's a long-term project, but for that initial documentary, what's
yes.
your goal?
Our hope is to complete post-production by fall 2015. And, you know, as documentaries go, typically then get launched into kind of the film festival market, mm-hmm. which will largely be 2016. And
right.
then we're hoping to have it, you know, available to audiences by, I guess, late 2016, 2017.
Right.
And for our production company, this isn't simply a film. We're actually intending to build a curriculum around it, an mm-hmm. educational curriculum that we hope then to launch in American colleges mm-hmm. and Canadian universities. And we're also hoping to make curriculums for high school as well mm-hmm. so that we can use conversations about mixed race to actually further complicate discussions about race for students. Because it helps,
right.
and not simply questions of race, but also just more broadly identity.
Right.
So much of the film will be focused on how young people build their identity, especially when it's complicated by having to choose a race, which seems to be a very common experience for people who identify as multiracial.
Hmm. Well, it's a terrific project, and it sounds really interesting, and I look forward to eventually seeing the documentary and seeing what you do after that and some of these initiatives, which sound really, really great and something for me growing up, I'm not that old, but going through school, I mean, we didn't have anything really to talk about race at all.
Right.
Other than race isn't bad.
Right.
All right, let's move on. Like, that's basically what it was, right? But so the opportunity to discuss with a little more nuance and a little more subtlety issues of race and identity and ethnicity is really important as we, you know, moving forward, as we try to really root out racism and prejudice in this world. Like,
mm-hmm.
these sorts of projects can help do that because they foster understanding of these issues.
That's certainly the hope, yes.
Mm-hmm. So all the best with that. Like you say, your Twitter handle is hiphopscholar82.
Yes.
And the project, the coloring book documentary, at ColoringBK, coloring spelled the proper way. And check out the website. Check out all the information they have on there. And if you want to support, please support it.
Absolutely. Yes.
So, Francesca D'Amico, York University, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.